Good day, Montreal, and everybody listening on the World Wide Web. With me in studio, as always, Rick McConomy. Rick, good morning, good day.
Good day, good day.
A lot of things happened this week. Budget, omnibus crime bills and justice bills, all of which we'll be talking about later on in the show. We want to start, though, with a very special look at two critical problems. The first being Darfur. We've often talked on the show of individual responsibility. We've talked about the responsibility to protect and how it's not just on the government or on the military. It's up to all of us to raise our voice. And we sometimes manifest it through foreign policy demonstrations, through discussions with government. But often, you've got to do it on your own. You've got to get out there. A very close friend of Rick's, who became a friend of ours at the Institute, always ends his emails to me with a quote from Winston Churchill that, doing the best we can is not enough. We must do and succeed at everything that is necessary. We'll be back after our break with a very special guest, Ruth Wyler-Messenger, who was singularly responsible for organizing the 75,000-person rally for Darfur in Washington last weekend. This is the largest manifestation yet on that horrible situation. We at the Institute helped organize one of the first in Montreal, with Rabbi Reuben Pupko and Reverend Daryl Gray. And it's 2 years of demonstrations in Canada just to get the Canadian government to call it a genocide. And somehow the critical mass of people necessary weren't there. And this was an extraordinary demonstration in Washington, Rick, and there were others throughout North America that day. There was nothing came close to it.
And I can remember how moved I was at the one that we had here when we had someone from Darfur. And, you know, these things come to the front pages. 2 solid years ago, okay, we were looking basically at the issues there. We talk about never again, and here it is. We're on it again, genocide and confusion in the reaction, confusion in the ability of the Western democracies to even take a position.
We'll be following our discussion with Ruth with Alistair Gordon, who's president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies, who is a major part of their agenda pushes the Canadian government toward a greater engagement in democratic development and reminds us all, and we need reminding, that 60 years after the greatest Holocaust, we still have gone through Cambodia and Rwanda and Kosovo and on and on and on, and we don't seem to learn and we don't seem to get it, that we can change these things with individual engagement with our governments and pushing them to do it.
We have to stop the denial. We have to stop the idea that people shouldn't speak out and shouldn't be allowed to speak out.
It is up to us. We can't do it. So we'll be back, and we'll start the show with Ruth Wyler-Messenger from New York and Alistair Gordon from Ottawa, and we'll be back with you right after this. 200,000 lives lost, 2 million refugees, killing squads called Janjaweed coming into villages, raping, burning husbands in front of their families, government airplanes following the killing squads, incinerating the villages, massive starvation, massive dislocation. The place is Darfur, West Sudan, Central Africa. It is one of the great human tragedies on a par with Rwanda. Years of demonstrations, small, medium, calling on the Canadian government to call it a genocide. Never a critical mass of people out there. Until last weekend, when a remarkable woman named Ruth Wyler-Messenger, who is the executive director of the American Jewish World Service, was credited with organizing the largest demonstration to bring this issue forward. 75,000 people in Washington, D.C. Ruth Messenger has devoted her life to the causes that matter. Her 1997 campaign for mayor in New York, she had served as Manhattan Borough president, was a hurrah, not a last hurrah, for the fundamentals of liberalism. Ruth Messenger has always understood that public service, above all, is done to relieve suffering. And if you don't have a visceral revulsion at suffering, you shouldn't be in it. And at a time of inelegant consumerism and total self-absorption, she was a voice, an authentic voice of industrial liberalism, and carried forward that work when she joined the American Jewish World Service in the late 1990s. Nancy Kaufman, of the Jewish Community Relations Council of Greater Boston, says there was no one who has really been a moral voice for vulnerable people in the world more than Ruth Messenger, and she was a moral compass in this drive. And we're honored and privileged to have with us Ruth Weiler Messenger to discuss this critical issue and also to discuss this remarkably successful demonstration last weekend in Washington. Ruth Messenger, welcome, and thank you for taking the time.
Thank you very much. I'm delighted to be on the air. Thank you.
Ruth, I mentioned in the introduction earlier that we've been involved at the Institute of Public Affairs in demonstrations for DeVore for 2 years in Canada. There are signs now that this new government will actually call what it is, which is a genocide. But the impetus seems to be coming for all these manifestations from faith-based communities. Did you find that when you were organizing this rally?
Yes, the highest level of concern has come from various faith-based communities. That's one way and one place to reach people is in their homes of worship or people who listen to religious leaders. Because I run the American Jewish organization that works in the developing world, we devoted much of our time to mobilizing the Jewish community, but there were many Christian and some Muslim groups that also work to mobilize their communities. Now, there's one addition to that, and it's very visible in Canada, and that is the student movement, STAND, which stands for Students Taking Action Now, DARFUR. STAND Canada has been a very powerful force in educating people about what's going on, and I believe in mobilizing people at several of your various different rallies.
Yes, they had a rally of about 1,000 people in Toronto. I believe a gentleman named Asaf Weiss ran it.
Right.
Why do you think, where is the I hate to use the term, but the traditional, I was about to say old line, the traditional smaller liberal communities, why have they, there's a feeling out there that there's a certain smugness in the liberal world, that it's sort of social justice stops at our borders, and before we get to the work of the AJWS, we feel that very strongly in Canada. Have you seen that develop over the past 10 years in the United States, that the traditional liberal, non-faith-based political constituencies are not that involved as they should be in foreign trouble spots?
Well, I think there's been a sort of a decline in social justice activism in every scale, in every place. I think that pendulum is swinging back, which is very encouraging. But yes, I would agree with you. To the extent that people are concerned, they seem more concerned about issues in their home communities, issues that affect themselves or their pocketbook, issue that affects the people that they, in some degree or other, interact with or see every day. And the further afield you go from what people know, the harder it is for them to focus. And certainly in this genocide in Darfur, a lot of the response was, you know, I can't follow what happens in Africa, but it's never any good, so how do you know that this is genocide and not tribal war? When we had clear evidence, as you said earlier, that it was the government of Sudan that was bombing the people of its own western states.
Does this have something to do with the new, smaller, liberal attitude that, well, if we focus abroad on injustices and on murder, on a mass murder, we may have to have a military response, and, gee, we can't be seen as being pro-militarist in anything or pro-interventionist in anything, even on the responsibility to protect?
I think that certainly is some of it. And remember, although you very powerfully used this term, responsibility to protect, and I gather you've talked about it before,
yes,
it's a very new world concept. And as you're correctly saying, it comes at a time when a lot of players, don't want to really think about world responsibility. I don't want to get off on a discussion of the American president who did the right thing on Darfur last week, and with whom I often do not agree, but I just want to point out that when he ran for office, he talked as if he was only going to be a domestic president, without recognizing that the role that what is happening in the world, that the impact of globalization, that the role America plays in the world, would inevitably require him to deal with one international issue and crisis after another.
Ruth Messenger, we'll be right back with you right after this break.
Okay.
Montreal, we're back. Rick McConomy in the studio with me. We're on the line from New York as Ruth Messenger, Executive Director of the American Jewish World Service. Rick, we're going to continue talking to Ruth, of course, and she's just raised this issue we've been talking about so much on this program, the responsibility to protect, which, of course, was an initiative that Canada started in backing the International Commission on State Sovereignty and Intervention, which said that without the UN's approbation, when there is a population in peril, free nations have a responsibility to protect citizens of the world wherever they are.
Yes, but we still wait for the recognition of the situation. And Ruth, I wanted to ask you, that this recognition that the president gave last week to the genocide in Darfur, does it automatically mean that resources are applied, or is that a second phase that has to be followed?
No, what the president did last week was to acknowledge the power of the rally to start saying that the American public was not prepared to continue to stand idly by during a genocide. And he intervened to both send Assistant Secretary of State Robert Zoellick back to the peace talks in Abuja, Nigeria, and to insist that the president of Sudan send his vice president. So that resulted in this, I would say, fairly fragile agreement being signed. But as you just correctly asked, that's a first step to now the various powers going to the Security Council saying, look, Sudan has now agreed to disarm the Janjaweed militia. So we know from experience that that's not going to happen unless there's a UN peacekeeping force on the ground, unless perhaps there's a NATO bridging force until the UN can mobilize its peacekeeping forces. And it also, the signing of this peace agreement doesn't do anything yet about the fact that the World Food Program had to cut its food services to the people, the 3 million hungry people in Darfur, in half last week because of a lack of money from government. So I don't know for a fact where you guys are on this in Canada, but your government ought to be urged to up its contributions to the World Food Program for the people of Darfur, or the victims of this genocide are going to starve to death before we are able to create a meaningful peace on the ground.
Ruth, the American Jewish World Service has done a remarkable job with you as president in attacking social problems abroad, including great work in the relief aid during the tsunami disaster. Can you give us a profile of some of the things you guys have tackled?
Yes, we're probably better known at any given moment for some relief or disaster interventions, such as the two you just mentioned, Darfur and tsunami. But, for example, in the tsunami region, we have told every group, grassroots group in five affected countries, that we'll be there for the long haul, that the money that we raise in response to the tsunami will be spent over 5 years, because as important as relief interventions are, our longer-range interest is to help communities rebuild themselves and take new steps toward the building of civil society. And that's a way to go further and say that our core work, which unfortunately doesn't ever make the newspapers, but which you can read about on www.ajws.org.
I was just about to mention it to the listeners.
Thank you. That core work is small-scale, grassroots, international development. We find the groups that are doing agricultural reform or microfinance or literacy or HIV/AIDS prevention in Asia, Africa, and the Americas, and we're now supporting 220 such groups in about 36 different countries, and that's extremely rewarding group work. And when we work or partner with any one of these grassroots organizations, we not only provide them with financial aid and technical assistance, but we very often send them volunteers, because the other big thing we do is to run an array of service programs that allow both Americans and Canadians from the Jewish community to go to the developing world and lend their skills, their muscle, their interest, and their abilities.
And broader even than the Jewish community, AJWS and the Save Darfur Coalition did deliver 760,000 signed postcards to President Bush.
Absolutely, and that was, as you say, an effort of a very broad coalition, and as you made the point before, a lot of whose members are a diverse group of faith-based organizations, but not exclusively that. Many organizations are secular human rights organizations, the National Association for the Advancement of Colored People. A lot of other groups participated in the broad postcard campaign, Africa Action.
We would urge all our listeners, www.ajws.org. This is a remarkable organization. Ruth Messenger, President and Executive Director, pursuing global justice through grassroots change.
Keep up the good work, Ruth. You're on the right track.
Very, very much.
Thanks. We thank you very much for taking time to be with us.
Great.
And anything we can ever do for you, please call.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Good
thank
luck.
You.
Montreal will be right back after the news with Alistair Gordon of the Canadian Council for Democracies. And Colin, we'd like to hear from all of you. Any experiences you've had, anything you've done in efforts to get involved in mankind's transcendent yearning for redemptive change. The responsibility that we as free citizens, privileged citizens, have to the responsibility to protect others. Perhaps no Canadian organization has been so involved, and I might say so effective and eloquently so, to push this nation toward a more active engagement in democratic development than the Canadian Coalition for Democracies. And we're privileged to have its president, Alistair Gordon, on with us today, and he's taking time off from a conference in Ottawa. Al Gordon, welcome. Thanks for your time.
Thank you, Beryl, and thanks for that very kind introduction. Not sure it's deserved, but I'll take it.
It's very good to have you with us, Al.
It's very well deserved. Al, we were talking to Ruth Messenger just the previous segment, of course, and she was instrumental in the massive rally in Washington for Darfur, and generally as part of their mandate at the AJWS is to push governments to speak the truth and speak the truth to tyrannies and create a foreign policy based on social justice. And you've done outstanding work in this. And I'm looking over some of the comments you've had since the Harper government has come in. And I think we can all agree that this government has given us some pride and purpose back on the world stage. They responded effectively to Hamas. They said, yeah, democratically elected, but until it renounces violence, it's not legitimate. They outlawed the Tamil Tigers, finally. The trip to Kandahar by Stephen Harper really gave us a sense of purpose in this country. Are you optimistic going forward about what this government is going to do as far as Canadian engagement abroad?
Yeah, I think I am very optimistic. In fact, the change in atmosphere since the election, I think, has been absolutely extraordinary. I used to be in chronic despair about every initiative or statement made by the last government, and now I find...
You mean you didn't like Paul Martin calling Gaddafi a man with a philosophical bent of mind?
Oh, I thought it was just wonderful. when he put a finer point on it by sending Pettigrew to lay a wreath at the grave of one of the biggest killers of Jews of the last century, I thought that was a wonderful piece of Canadian foreign policy. And now we compare, as you know, you've said, cut off funding to Hamas. We voted against 43 other nations to support Israel at the first of this year's anti-Israel UN resolutions. You know, he's announced the Air India investigation. I think all these things are extraordinary developments. I think one of the major problems that the challenges that this government faces is not its own lack of humanitarian will or democratic impulse. I think it is going to be facing such a fight from the bureaucracy that will implement these policies. And I think that has to be one of their top priorities.
And we've seen that already in the interaction between Harper and McKay, and we'll be right back to discuss that. Al Gordon, just stay with us. We'll be right back with you after the short break. Montreal, we're talking about Canada's responsibility to protect and our responsibility as individuals to get involved and engage in pushing our government on those issues that matter abroad. We're privileged to have with us Al Gordon, the president of the Canadian Coalition for Democracies, one of Canada's most eloquent voices for our greater engagement in democratic development. I urge all of you to go to their website, CanadianCoalition.com. This is an organization that deserves your support, both moral and material. Al, we have Mike on the line who's got a question. Mike? You're on.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks for having me on board. You guys hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Al, can you hear Mike?
I can hear him, yep. Very
okay,
well.
I'll talk louder because my phone's kind of crappy. Okay, I think the biggest problem with respect to democracy is that democracy is often used to suppress the minority, where the ill majority suppresses the libertarian rights of the minority. Would you please differentiate to the masses the difference, or if you can, between just majority and ill majority? And when you do so, which one applies to 30 years of, you know, pseudo-legalized and institutionalized racist Quebec?
Well, I think one of the, you know, you raise a very interesting point, Mike, and I think one thing that we need to realize, I'll just reflect for a second on the international stage, is that one election doth not a democracy make. Quite often people will point to the fact that we have to recognize Hamas, for example, because it was democratically elected. but one election is a necessary but not sufficient condition for a democracy. You also need to have a constitution that does not call for the destruction of a neighboring country and that calls for the respect for democracies, which clearly those major ingredients are missing from the Palestinian democratic experiment. Now, you mentioned in Canada the fact that we've endured 30 years of oppression of certain minority interests, and I certainly tend to agree with you, although basically one could also argue that we had the government we deserved because we continued to elect them. However, that particular government certainly did a lot of things to try and assure that it remained the perpetual natural governing party through immigration, through the funding of NGOs, through distorting foreign policy to please certain groups, even though it was against the interests of Canadians. So I think you're right. There has been a corruption of democracy over the past 30 years in Canada, but I'm hoping that that corruption is neither permanent nor unfixable.
And what are the things, Al, that we have to turn around in order to make that that direction change?
What are the things we need to turn around?
Basically, yeah.
Well, I would say that there are changes needed in a whole lot of areas. For example, when a democracy elects a government, as it has now elected the Harper government, the civil service should exist to execute the will of that democratically elected government. Well, what we have today in many government departments is a bureaucracy that is exercising, in many cases, its own agenda and not the will of a democratically elected government.
Al, I think one of the things also you try in your talks and your organization tries to teach Canadians is that social justice, to address Mike's point, is a top-down issue. And if we don't show leadership in social justice abroad, then our social justice policies at home are going to suffer. And if we're going to be smugly thinking that we're all right, Jack, and the hell with everybody else, then everything will suffer here as well.
Yeah, I would like to see both domestic and international policy driven by the same moral compass for exactly the reason you just articulated. I agree.
Mike, what do you have to say on that?
Well, I just want to indicate the issue in Quebec is that it is an ill majority. It is suppressing the minority's rights. How do we define ill majority? The individual's rights are not protected by the ill majority's state. Just majority, which the United States, which we so conveniently often, not myself, but many pseudo-Canadians, what I call them, criticize the United States, is just majority. That means that the individual's rights will be protected even though it conflicts with the just majority's state.
Mike, you're talking about the classic collective rights versus civil rights. Mike, thank you so much
for your help. Thank you for your time. Have a good day.
Just to clarify for our listeners, Mike brings up some good points, but the mandate of the CCD is to get Canada on the world stage involved in the fight for recognition and support of democratic movements. So what Mike said, Al, had a lot of important points for us domestically, but your major mandate is to get Canada and its leadership moving abroad with our traditional allies and toward our traditional Western liberal pluralist values and supporting those movements abroad.
Are there specific targets, Al, that you have at the moment?
Yes, there are certainly quite a number of specific targets that we're looking at that we would like to see change, and I'm happy to say that this government is giving us less to complain about. It would be wonderful if we if they could put us out of business. Some of the more specific targets we have would include, for example, I mentioned the fixing the bureaucracy so it executes the will of the government that pays them, not their own private agendas.
Right.
It would include a change in our China-Taiwan policy, in which Paul Martin signed a one China policy, in which basically a matter that is absolutely none of Canada's business, we signed an agreement saying that the democratic will of 23 million people in Taiwan doesn't matter. As far as we're concerned, Taiwan is part of the People's Republic of China, and of course, Taiwan has never, ever been part of the People's Republic of China. So it was an outstanding act of imperialism.
So there are two real targets that you're working on at the moment.
Sure. And I can give you another major target is we've cut off the funding to Hamas because of its blatantly terrorist nature, as opposed to the previous Palestinian government with its secretly terrorist nature. But that was a great move to cut it off. However, we are continuing to fund the United Nations Relief and Work Agencies, UNRWA, whose mission it has long been to support Hamas, to engage in terror, to engage in incitement and inflammation of the refugee problem, not to solve it.
And it's doubtful that that money is hitting the ground, getting through to the actual targets of good not being skimmed off at the top. We've been hearing that over the last 15 weeks.
Well, that's right. I mean, I think every dollar that goes to UNRWA could arguably be used for making the situation worse, not just for the killing and maiming of Israelis, which on video their assets are seen supporting this, but the ongoing incitement and hatred spread in the schools in the camps run by UNRWA.
Al, I know you're pressed for time. You're at a conference. A closing question. Are you feeling that Canadians on the ground, as you go around the country and eloquently make your points and your colleagues from the CCD, do you find that Canadians are getting it, that it's not enough just to worry about their little quarter acre of land and I'm all right, Jack, and the hell with everybody else? Are they getting the message that we've got to be involved?
I think, yes. I think there is a definite improvement. There's a long way to go. I was just struck by your previous guest, Ruth Messenger, and the actions they're taking directly, like every normal citizens are taking in defense of the victims in Darfur. I think Canadians overwhelmingly look to the government to solve these problems and don't feel they themselves have any responsibility. I think that's why our charitable giving is so low compared to Americans.
Right.
And I think if some of that spirit could be imbued in this country, Canadian awareness and involvement of the need to participate would help the revolution that I hope has started with the last election.
And if anybody helped to start it, it's the eloquence and elegance of Al Gordon, and we wish you the best of luck and our support, and thank you for taking time out from your conference to be with us today.
Thanks so much, Beryl.
Once again, our listeners, CanadianCoalition.com, Canadian Coalition for Democracy, will be back right after this. Instead of creating state-run bureaucracies to preach the virtues of public engagement, this government is using the tax system to encourage citizens to opt in. The focus of this government's program is what could be termed soft paternalism. Rather than forcing choices on its citizens, such as banning junk foods, governments induce them to make the choice it deems beneficial, and which happens to be better. And instead of overt nanny state, you get an almost invisible hand pointing the way. Those eloquent words written by our next guest, Executive Vice President of the Montreal Economic Institute, Tasha Kearden, about the Conservative budget. Tasha, welcome, thank you for joining us on Sunday.
Pleasure, Beryl. Thank you.
Your words seem to ring with some hope for all of those of us who I know, like you, share the hope that we can have a government rollback from the nanny state. Do you believe this budget was a good first step up?
I think it is a good first step. You have to distinguish between what's called soft paternalism and hard paternalism, which is the latter being people telling you implicit absolutely what to do. The absolute best situation, of course, is complete freedom in the sense that you have the lowest tax rate possible and you're as free as possible to do with your money what you want. Governments, though, always do have a tendency to try and shape society. So if they're going to do it, I would rather see them do it with incentives that say you can get a tax break if you behave this way than to say you absolutely have to do this or we'll tax you more.
Right. Many of us, in listening to the Prime Minister's words over the past several years, were also of the hope that a lot of the nanny state programs, as you called it and as we all call it, might be rolled back. We have $25 billion in a federal budget of about $165 billion that's spent in this whole multicultural, touchy-feely, statocratic engineering complex. Now, we know we have a minority government right now, so he's he has to tread carefully. But do you see going forward that we'd actually have a rollback of some of this?
Well, I think you're seeing a rollback in terms of funding of some programs and interest groups. You saw that on the environmental side. You saw it with the end of the Council for Canadian Unity. The government is pulling out. It's in a minority situation, so it can't create programs, but it certainly can defund them and allow the market to take its course in those terms. If people want to start up groups to favor Canadian unity, the argument, I guess, would be is they can do it, but they won't be doing it at the taxpayers' expense. And presumably also it will be more accountable if it's set up by private interests than it will be if it's set up by a government bureaucracy to which, you know, as we saw the sponsorship scandal, there was no account.
On the fiscal side, how much does the budget help the middle class that's been so burdened by the massive tax shift that the Martin government made onto the middle class?
Well, the budget is clearly targeted at middle class, and specifically at middle class families. If you have children who are in school, they get a textbook credit, for example. If you have kids who are going to play sports, you get a sports credit. So in that sense, it clearly does target the middle class taxpayer who's got to pay the bills for the kids. It's increasing the basic personal exemption. It's presenting a worker's tax credit. So if you're working, as most middle class taxpayers are, you get a benefit there. It's clearly also, from that sense, it's a political budget. I mean, economically, they should have kept the lowest tax rate, the 15%. That's no question. Increasing it to 15.5 was silly. They should have kept that as the lowest basic tax rate. They didn't. Apart from that, though, it is a budget that will help the middle class.
Tash, please stay with us. We'll be right back after this break. So we're talking about the budget, and our special guest, and thanks for your patience, is Tasha Kierden, Executive Vice President of the Montreal Economic Institute. Montreal people are very happy with this budget. We want to know if you are. Tasha, do you see the day coming when, in a different sort of government with a majority, we're actually going to see an important tax rollback to the Canadian people? And I know that your institute has advocated for that, as well as help toward industry to make Canada more tax competitive.
Mm-hmm. One would hope that the federal government would cut taxes further, and one can speculate. I don't know what the conservatives, if they were reelected, would do. One could speculate they may lower taxes further if they were in a majority situation. I don't know, but whatever government would get in next time, we would like to see a tax rollback. Canadians have been overtaxed for the past 7 years. I mean, ever since the budget has been balanced, the government's been racking up bigger and bigger surpluses. That's really overtaxation
and taking them into the general accounts.
Yes, absolutely. And the problem is that, people get sort of used to this and forget that, in fact, close to 50% of your income is being taken away by various levels of government, and particularly the federal government, where there's definitely room to reduce taxes.
But, Tasha, there is the other issue, which is that if you cut back on all the social programs, I mean, is there an expectancy that this government has some kind of handle on some kind of war on poverty? Or?
Well, it's not, Rick, it's not the social programs this government's attacking. It's protecting the vulnerable. It's protecting the Social Security safety net. It's all those statocratic engineering programs that have nothing to do with the CPP that the Liberals took the surplus out of, or the UI fund, or welfare. We're talking about those programs that have nothing to do with the base Social Security safety net, but those programs that are nothing but cheap vote grabbing schemes that have been racked up over 13 years.
Yeah, but when the carving happens, Tasha, talk to us about that.
Well, I mean, there's room for savings, generally speaking, in any bureaucracy. I think the federal government is no exception, and I think that there is a willingness to start trimming the fat, if you will, and the inefficiencies there. There are certain programs also, such as the Federal Long Gun Registry, which has not made Canada any safer. Gun crime has increased. We've seen increased violence in particularly the cities of Toronto, Vancouver. Long gun registries will not affect the fact that criminals get their hands on handguns. More police, more ability to investigate and to break up gangs, that sort of thing, will probably decrease the gun crime rate. That's where the resources should be put. So
absolutely, the visible deterrence.
Yeah, I mean, I know in Quebec it's a very sensitive issue because of the polytechnique and the history behind it.
Absolutely.
But at the same time, when you look at the facts, it's hard to argue in favor of maintaining a registry that costs $1 billion. That money could be much better.
I'm concerned about the commitment to those social programs that are at the core. Is there a sense that this government understands what they are, where they're going, and that they have to be managed more and more efficiently?
Well, I mean, I can't speak for this government. I think, though, that there's a recognition by them that Canadians have to play or be allowed to play a greater role in shaping their own futures and destinies. I think that is reflected in the child care program, for example. Child care has been on the table with various governments for 20 years. Should we have a national child care strategy? And this ignores the fact that, A, there's no proof that all Canadians want to put their kids in daycare, B, that it's in fact the best thing for all kids, and C, that having a variety of delivery models isn't in fact better, giving people the choice. And that's what this government's opting for. I don't know how they'll treat other social programs if they'll start doing the same thing, but I think it's encouraging to see that they will put more faith in the parents' ability to decide what's best for their kids and just create another bureaucracy. And we've seen it in Quebec, where you end up having much higher wages, much higher costs than were anticipated for the public purse to bear.
Plus the change in the deductibility of transferring assets to charities and organizations is a step in that direction also.
Absolutely. I think increasing the presence of the voluntary sector where people will choose to help other people. I think any society where people choose to do that is, in fact, a more compassionate society than where you simply say, oh, well, you know, it's the government's problem to deal with the poor people. No, it's all of our problem. All of us have to make an effort, whether it's contributing time or money to volunteer organizations. That's how you build communities and neighborhoods, not by leaving it to a faithless bureaucracy to say, oh, yeah.
Tasha, thank you so much for this.
You're welcome.
We started this, Tasha, with a quote from you that was very eloquent, and you just used another one, that government's fiscal policies must be reflective of the ability of individuals to pursue their own destinies. And that's the bottom line, and that should be the bottom line. And we know that that's one of your mandates at the Institute, and you're doing it tremendously well. And we thank you for taking the time out to be with us.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, Beryl.
Tasha, thank you.
Thank you, Tasha.
Montreal will be right back after this. The week started out with a budget that was generally popular throughout the country. The week ended with a couple of justice bills that have a lot of problems. Perhaps the most troubling aspects of the justice bills that were presented on Friday were the aspects that dealt with mandatory minimums for a new variety of offenses that related to guns and drugs, and unconditional sentencing, taking the power away from judges to determine the parameters in sentencing. Almost all Western European countries have done away with mandatory minimums. They don't work. There's been no evidence that they work. We have a panicked reaction in Canada every time there's a shooting. I'd like to remind all our listeners that Canada has a violent crime rate of 1.9 per 100,000, while the United States has 5.5. Putting aside the numbers, these laws could increase Canada's prison population from 12,400 to 17,900, with $245 million being set aside in the budget for building two prisons, when what we need are visible deterrents and more police. And with us to discuss other aspects of these justice bills, in addition to mandatory minimums that are highly troubling on the civil liberties front, is renowned civil liberties attorney Julius Gray. Julius, thanks for taking time out on Sunday to be with us.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Good afternoon, Julius.
Good afternoon.
These bills seem to be reflective, and correct me if I'm wrong, of a general... Here we have a government who's against autocratic control, and yet they were very reflective of a culture of control that we've seen for over a decade.
Well, that's like...
What are we doing wrong?
That's like the Bush government. The Bush government wants smaller government, but it wants prisons, security everywhere. It's not that they want smaller governments, it's they want to control different things. Instead of building hospitals, instead of building schools, funding universities, they want to have prisons, control, fear. And it's a philosophy, it's a form of demagogy, just like lowering GST is a form of demagogy, because it's been proved by all economists that it's the very worst way of getting tax cuts. But it's electoralist, it's popular, and it's based on a
It's number. Pandering.
Yeah, it's pandering, but it's populism. You see, what that horrible thing called populism, which is 99% of the time a right-wing phenomenon, occasionally there's such a thing as left-wing populism, but it's this majoritarianism, this fake common sense. And it's not, I'm not saying this in a condescending way. The average person would understand, but the average person hasn't studied the criminology, hasn't done everything, so they bring in sort of fake common sense. And you know, the previous government was also guilty.
Is that the common sense that backs up mandatory minimums,
Julius?
Mandatory minimums have no purpose whatsoever. First of all, it means you don't trust our judges. You don't think that there are cases where, no matter how serious the offense, there is some room for discretion. Look at the Latimer case and everything else. There's no reason to have a mandatory minimum. What you need is a sane division of offenses into more or less serious. The second thing that you've got is this belief that, you know, we're now working throughout North America in the belief that people who commit crimes, any type of crime, are evil and they can't really be rehabilitated. So we don't believe in rehabilitation. We think we've got to keep them there as long as possible. If they get out a day early and commit an offense, it's a big scandal. Well, it's not a big scandal, is it? I mean, we don't see headlines every day about the large number of people who have been convicted for nothing and spent years and years and years in jail. There is absolutely no reason to increase sentences, to decrease national parole jurisdiction in a country which is one of the lowest crime rates, and where when we remember that no matter how hard we try, there's always, as long as human beings will exist, there will be some people who don't obey the law for whatever reason, madness, passion, viciousness. There will be some, no matter what we do, and it's absolutely ridiculous to waste our money on this when we need it for pensions, for health.
And unfortunately, most people, as you said, don't know the numbers and the facts. They don't know that the numbers of people who commit violent crimes are 80 to 90% are either crimes of passion or crimes committed by criminals against other criminals. Well, nobody's got to think about whether there's a law, but if there's a visible deterrent of more cops. Giuliani, when he cleaned up New York, he's cleaned up in apostrophes, didn't want more laws, but he put 10,000 more cops on the street.
Well, but the answer to that one is, but that only works, what he did was he cleaned up a little portion of New York. The crime is still there. It's just that it's in the ghetto and tourists don't see it. Now, there may be a very good reason for doing it, he'd argue. Look what he's done for the tourist industry. But nevertheless, over-policing is not the answer either. I think education is the answer. I think health care is the answer. For instance, when they cut down the availability of psychiatric services, they are increasing the crime rate, inevitably, within 3 or 4 or 5 years, when people will not be counseled, will not be helped, and will not be given drugs when new and miraculous families of medications that are available, and they won't do it.
We end up incarcerating people that are really just off their meds.
But then the worst part of it, when the public thinks, let's incarcerate, they don't know the statistics. They don't know that crime is falling. But they also do not know about unjust convictions, and they don't know that this could happen to everybody. Well, most people think they're virtuous, they're right. If they really examine their life in detail for the last 20 or 30 years, think of what they've done and what they haven't done, they'll know that any person could end up being accused of something very serious. I mean, all you have to do...
Julius, I'm sorry to interrupt you. We just got to pay some bills. We'll be right back with you.
Yeah.
Thank you.
We're back, and we're talking with Julius Gray on what's wrong with this criminal justice bill in Montreal. Please call in, and let's see if you understand the dangers of mandatory minimums and unconditional sentencing and the irrelevance of it.
I'll just make one remark. The average man does not know that he can be convicted of impaired driving, even if he's under .08, if he has had one drink and there's a bit of smell and a policeman thinks he's driving erratically. You can be convicted. You can have a criminal record in some cases. If there's an accident, you could even go to jail. And people don't know that they, too, can be in the defendant's seat. They always see these terrible people. And part of it is, of course, our society's excessive victim mentality. Everybody's competing for the position.
Julius, there's a recent judgment of the Court of Appeal in the Coffin case that took away discretion on for judges to be able to give community work and things along that line and discourage that particular type of sentencing. Is that part of this problem?
Well, I think that's a terrible judgment. I disagree with it with all my heart. I think Mr. Justice Boilat, who was not particularly soft, known as being particularly soft, He got it right in the first instance. There was no reason to incarcerate Mr. Coffin. There's no reason to have your pound of flesh in all of these cases when people were part of a culture of corruption and they did what everybody else around them did. They've been punished. They've been humiliated. They've been disgraced. We should show a little bit of largesse, and nobody wants to do that.
What is the biggest threat to our civil liberties from the unconditional sentencing that judges will now have to be forced to do if this bill passes?
Well, what it means is that people who do not deserve it will be in jail for long periods of time. What it means is that jail will become a serious possibility for people who are not dangerous, who don't see themselves or nobody else sees them as criminals. It's just something happens, and everybody is going to have to live with the possibility that one day in life they will be incarcerated.
Wrong place at the wrong time.
Wrong place at the wrong time or stupid decision at the wrong time or whatever it is that happens to people in these circumstances. It's that complete lack of understanding of what life is really like and how people go astray or are mistakenly taken to go astray.
Julius Gray, many thanks for being with us. Montreal and Canada, I hope you've been listening and that you guard against being all of us becoming a nation of knee-jerk reaction. We'll be right back after this. Tomorrow, drug enforcement officers from across the globe will meet in Montreal for a conference funded by the United States Drug Enforcement Administration. This is one of a series of conferences that are regularly funded by the DEA, and there are a number of people who don't believe that a government should be involved at all in the criminalization of a lot of drugs, and B, certainly that enforcement policies should not be reflective of American standards, which tend to be rather draconian. There is a counter-symposium tomorrow that will be held in Montreal, sponsored by the British Columbia Civil Liberty Association, the Canadian Foundation for Drug Policy, LEAP, the Law Enforcement Against Prohibition, and the University of Ottawa Criminology Department, with a demonstration at noon, a brief rally with speeches in Dorchester Square, Place de Canada, the corner of Peel and Levesque. And joining us right now for a brief discussion on what they hope to accomplish is Dan Romano, the founder and the president of CAGE, Citizens Against Government Encroachment. Dan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's great to be back.
Thanks for taking the time this Sunday. Dan, tell us a little bit about this counter-response.
Well, basically, it's an effort to educate the public, let people know that there is an alternative viewpoint, and that a lot of what the U.S. government is doing and trying to impose on its neighboring countries is very counterproductive.
Counterproductive in what sense, Dan?
Well, there's three arguments against the drug policy in this war on drugs. There's political, practical, and logical. The political argument is very much what Beryl and what some of your prior speakers were speaking about, that the government should not be imposing its point of view on individuals. It refers back to the John Stuart Mill's harm principle. If somebody wants to harm themselves, you let them. You only interfere with their personal liberty if they're going to harm others, right? So that's the political argument. The practical, which is what tomorrow's conference is going to be about, is that addresses the huge fallacy of the war on drugs. The point of view of a lot of the people who will be speaking, these are police officers, judges, narcotics officers with as much as 30 years experience in drug enforcement who will be speaking against this. They're saying that the war on drugs is causing far more problems than solving. In fact, it's not solving any problems at all.
So all of these mainstream people are coming to your counter demonstration, right?
Well, they're more than just mainstream. These are the people who are on the front line of the drug war. And these aren't just retired police officers. These are active police officers, narcotics officers. These are the heroes of the war on drugs who are realizing that it's only causing harm and it's not solving any problems because they put one pusher in jail, five of them jump to take his place because the war on drugs has raised the price of drugs so much by creating this artificial obstacle to entry without diminishing demand at all.
And there will also be discussion, of course, on the necessity of decriminalizing possession so that assets and resources of police forces can be turned toward other more serious crimes and getting the state out of the personal business of its citizens. Is that not right?
Well, absolutely. I also got one figure in front of me. It's on our website. It says the U.S. devotes $69 billion a year to its war on drugs. And I don't know if that includes the huge increase in its prison population as a result of the war on drugs, if that's part of a separate category. But, I mean, it's absurd the types of numbers we're talking about with no benefit whatsoever. There's been no diminishing in drug usage, no diminishment in addiction. It's been completely non-productive. well, at the same time causing a heck of a lot of harm, and it created such a powerful organized crime. Something we've not seen since the times of bootlegging when the alcohol prohibition was working. That was an abject failure as well.
Dan Romano, thanks for being with us today. Good luck tomorrow. We encourage people to come and listen. It's a noon rally, Dorchester Square, corner of Peel and René-Lévesque, and the conference itself is at the Marriott Chalet Champlain starting at 9:30. And for more information, please go to cagecanada.com, C-A-G-E, and this is an organization that
is .ca.
Sorry, cagecanada.ca, and we encourage our listeners to give us support to this organization that is really standing up for the rights of each of us as individuals to be freed from certain government bureaucratic controls.
Dan, you're
Romano,
fighting
thank
the good
you.
Fight. You're thank fighting you the good fight, Dan. Keep it up.
We'll be back right after this. Montreal, we're back with our closing segment where we're going to take a little more time than usual because this is a rather rare occasion. On the line with us is Calgary lawyer Brad Minyuk, and he'll be discussing the case of John Helm. Now, what makes this extraordinary is that the case of John Helm, who's Mr. Minyuk's client, is before legal tribunals. Brad felt it was important to bring the broad issues relating to this case before the public because they relate to a variety of problems and issues. What's wrong with our prison system? The problem of non-protection of people who are doing their jobs, non-protection by their unions, non-protection by their government, and a base injustice that was done to John Helm. Brad Minyuk, thank you for joining us on Sunday, and welcome.
Thank you. Pleasure to be on.
Good afternoon, Brad. Rick McConomy here in Montreal. We're looking at this situation, Brad, and we know there's litigation involved, and we want to be a little careful about getting into it, but there's a whistleblower aspect here that's very interesting to us. Is this not a case where somebody was doing their job and doing their job not overly zealously but inside the parameter, and somehow they're now caught up in a whole slew of unsupported reaction and and ramification?
Well, that's in this particular case, that's exactly what happened. This is a situation where Mr. Helm was a former prison guard at the Bowdoin Institution, which is just 500 clicks north of Calgary. It's
right.
A medium security prison. And he ended up suing Corrections Service Canada for wrongful dismissal. They fired Mr. Helm under legislation that allows federal employers to do so if an employee has been unable to return to work after a couple of years. And in Mr. Helm's case, he's alleging that he could not return to work due to Bowdoin's failure to provide him with the medical and emotional and financial support he was entitled to while injured in the line of duty.
So basically he has an illness that comes from his work, it's work-related, and the federal government has failed to back him on that.
And this is over a 12-year period, Rick, where he's had an exemplary record and has had two illnesses. Is that correct, Brad?
Yeah, I would have to suggest, though, that it took place under the Liberal government regime. It's not in the scope yet of the Conservative government, but they obviously have notification of.
Right, and they have a possibility of turning the situation around and doing the good. Basically, he's suffering from post-traumatic stress. Is that it?
Yeah, that's correct. What had happened was Mr. Helm was hired in 1998. Or sorry, 1988, he was extremely good at his job. He was very popular. He became the president of his union. He was never charged with impropriety. In fact, he received commendations. He was extremely adept at catching inmates with drugs, contraband, to the point where he began to interfere with the inmate drug trade. And as a result of that, the inmates began to hate him to the point where he and his family became targets of those inmates that were affected by John's ability to confiscate the
drugs. Now,
could you explain how his family became targets of the inmates?
His family was also targeted, and as a result of that, they at some point had to go into hiding, and they never received any financial assistance from the
penitentiary people there. Is that correct?
That's correct.
So basically what we're talking about here is, now, I wanted to know also, okay, you mentioned he was president of the union. Has his union stood up for him? Have they gone to battle for him?
It's another complicated problem, but there is an issue with respect to the union. It's not currently being dealt with. I can't really get into the merits of it, but I certainly would invite the union to contact me.
Now, Brad, John Helm has never been accused, either formally or informally, of being abusive or anything else. He was really doing his job and a proper job as a corrections officer.
Well, no, that's not completely the case. Initially, the inmates filed numerous falsified complaints against John. When I say the inmates, I'm saying some of the inmates had filed falsified complaints against John, prison administration, the RCMP, and members of parliament, allegedly for the purposes of having John fired. It went so far as to create a petition, which some of the inmates, or a good proportion of the inmates, signed. And when their efforts failed to work, some of the inmates resorted to threats and intimidation tactics to keep John from interfering with some of the prisoners' illicit drug trade activities. The threats intensified. There were 9 serious death threats and 10 assaults while he worked in the prison from 1990 to 2000. There was a total of 61 threats and assaults that were carried out against him over the course of his career. And in 1994, when the inmate complaints failed to produce that desired effect, the inmates created and implemented a plan to kill him. So, and it was just fortunate that the police were able to learn of these inmates' plans before they were able to carry them out. The prison discovered that the inmates had intended to both beat, stab, and then light John on fire with gasoline. They'd actually built themselves a knife. They stole a baseball bat from the gym.
And all of this has been documented. Have people been accused?
Yeah, this is all documented. As a matter of fact, not one complaint that was filed against John was upheld. Each one was independently reviewed. Some of these complaints can take anywhere from 3 weeks to 6 months to review and determine. And in effect, what was happening is every time that John would bust a convict of having a weapon or drugs or contraband or whatever, these inmates would face charges.
Brad, you during our conversation during this week, you very eloquently and very courageously explained why you felt that a resort to media and to the public was important, and I'd like you to expand on that right after this break. Montreal Reconcomy and I are talking with Calgary lawyer Brad Minyuk on the John Helm case and the difficulties that many people would face within a bureaucracy, in this case a prison guard, not being protected by his bosses and by the administration when he's just carrying out his job. Brad, before the break, I had asked you to share with our listeners the very eloquent and courageous reasons that you had for bringing this issue to the media, and I'd like you to repeat that so that Montreal and indeed Canada will hear it.
Well, I think it's a really simple concept. I mean, we've got a situation here that appeals to a broad-based group of individuals. Mr. Helm isn't doing this just for himself. He's also doing this because he's aware that there are a number of other corrections officers as well as people in security that are affected by this kind of a problem. In Mr. Helm's case, he suffers post-traumatic stress disorder, which is a serious debilitating injury psychologically that precludes him from working. It affects his day-to-day. It's essentially somebody who's been exposed to some horrific act that you relive it every day as though it was happening presently, and it precludes you from going forward. This has destroyed his career, this has destroyed his family, and this is because he was following the mandate of his obligations as a corrections officer to ensure that there was no contraband and drugs in the prison. And essentially what this comes down to is that the public, the government, and those in positions of supervisory capacities must ensure that the rights and the safety of Canadians acting in the capacity of security, whether it be the police, whether it be military, of course, corrections officers are properly educated, monitored, and they're provided with the financial and emotional support that these guys are entitled to as frontline work.
Well, Brad, you're fighting the good fight. Brad, you're in there. You're bringing these things to the public, and we hope Canada has heard you from coast to coast. I want to thank you very much for being with us today. Best of luck to you. Keep
Before
fighting the good
you,
fight.
Before you close, if I could invite anybody out there who has been affected by this, they can email me at brad@chipier.com. That's brad@chipier.com. It'll be confidential. We're interested in hearing your story.
There you are, Brad. Keep up the good
Brad,
fight.
Brad, thanks very much.
Thank you.
I have a little bit of kitchen stuff I wanted to hear, Brad, here, Beryl, before we leave. Some time ago, we talked about Dean Whalen organizing a a stepping contest all the way up the side of the mountain and back.
Right.
Gazette this morning announces that he's got $18,000 raised yesterday, and he'll be going on and continuing today, recognizing the contribution of the Westmount Police Department. Also, there's a 100th anniversary of the Loyola Alumni Association. Something's going to happen in September. There will be a gala, and between now and then, we invite all Loyola people to be sensitive to the requests and the suggestions and the help that you're going to be that's going to be sought from you. That's Loyola College 100th anniversary.
They'd have a great success if they just not honored you and forgot about everything else.
I'm thinking of that. I think they may change it from Loyola to McConaughey. Just, you know.
There should be at least a McConaughey Hall.
A family tradition. I think this is probably an excellent idea. Unfortunately, my $17 donation is not going to be able to.
I'll match it with, I'll double it. I'll give
18 and 18.
How's that?
We're done.
Montreal, thanks for listening. We want to thank Chris Smith, our technical operator, whose birthday was yesterday. Happy birthday, Chris.
Happy birthday. Dude.
Thanks to Val Prudnikov, our producer. And we want to leave you with the words we repeated earlier in the show that our good friend Bob Hest always sends to us and reminds us, Churchill's great words, that merely trying our best is not enough. We need to succeed in doing what is necessary. Montreal, good day. Good luck. We'll see you next week.
Keep up the good fight.